And so our first case is Talix Medical versus Beacon Medical, 2021-2069. Mr. Weaver.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rob Weaver. I'm on behalf of the Brickell IP Group. I'm here with my partner, Javier Sobrado, as well, representing Talix. My plan is to march through the appellate arguments. There's, of course, a cross-appeal, and then I'll leave it to your discretion if you want me to march into the cross-appeal arguments as well, or I can reserve to Mr. Kupar and then respond to him, whatever your preference is, right? So marching in. So we have three issues on appeal. First is the Claim 4 broad flat foot member. After that is the Claims 5, the reversibly engaged issue, the claim construction issue, and then after that is on the second patent, the 277 patent, which is that arc-shaped on the scaffold molding. So the arguments on on claims 4, the 942 patent, and on 277 patent, those are factual issues, right? We're looking for whether or not there's substantial evidence, and it's a very straightforward argument, frankly. Did the board miss it? Is there evidence that was of record that the board missed, that was there, that would have adjusted and resulted in a different outcome? On the broad flat foot member, what happened there was is that in the petition, the petitioner focused, Talix focused more on the broad flat foot member and its ability to stabilize the device, right? And in the decision to institute, the board did critique it. They made a decision to institute on those claims, but they made a critique and they said, well, that they were skeptical that that was enough. So in the reply brief, in the following depositions of the expert testimony, they clarified, they said, okay, the criticism from the board was that petition does not fully address how Dancy's seemingly narrow rim on the part that's up against the child's cranium, right? That narrow rim meets the broad requirement. And they came up with, and there's another reason that came out over the course of the trial, which is that it would cause irritation. That broad flat foot member was on the child, on a pediatric child, on a young child for over a year continuously, and then intermittently thereafter for another 9 months.
Is this argument that you're basing on inherency?
So the argument is that the prior art teaches or suggests. I'm not suggesting that there is a direct teaching in the sense that you can see it. That was the board's problem, right? Is that it does not appear. The picture of Dancy is flush with the child's cranium. You don't actually see what that is. So that's sort of the question, right? Is would a teacher suggest, would the prior art reference teacher suggest that that would be a necessarily broad flat foot member? And over the course of the trial became, well, it has to be. It absolutely has to be. Certainly it's at least suggested. Because otherwise it would have created an irritation. And that was unequivocal in the expert testimony as well, that there would be an irritation there. And the patent even talks about this. The patent discusses that anything contacting the skin could possibly lead to necrosis, which would be an extreme form of irritation. You know, skin is starting to deaden, right? And so that's the argument. And the problem is that the board doesn't address this. That's really the error, right? The board is a two sentence. The board's decision was a two sentence argument, only focusing on what was appearing. There was never a citation to the reply brief argument. There was never a citation to the expert testimony. They just missed it. And that was reversible error.
You want us to reversibly engage. Sounds like a double negative.
Let's talk about reversibly engaged, unless there's any other questions on the broad flat foot member. Reversibly engaged is a claim construction issue. We have two competing claim constructions, right? Talix is significant, is undeniably broader. The problem with beacons, scratch that. The board, I understand the board's criticism. The main problem for the board was that the Talix definition was so broad that it read out what reversibly meant, right? They said that the Talix definition was really just to engage or contact, to stabilize the device, right? It's a very broad definition. The problem is with Beacon is that reversibly, they define it in a way that it's with orientation to the ear, okay? It's with orientation to the patient's ear. There's nothing in the specification that ever talks about reversibly other than in the manner that the two surfaces are engaging with each other. So if you go into the specification, and this is the real problem, ours might be broad. I'm not going to deny that. Ours is a very broad definition, but at least fits. It at least fits and it makes sense within the specification. There's two instances within the specification that reversibly is used, right? One is within the horizontal and vertical surfaces and how they're engaging with each other, Okay. The other is with respect to the cradle, right? This is a, this component has two components, right? It's the mold.
Engagement, you're saying, is sort of the key word here.
I think engage is the key word, yes. It's not to suggest that reversibly has no definition, has no meaning. We've got to give meaning to everything.
And understanding how what's being reversed, it's the engagement that maybe is important, is what you're saying.
I agree with that, yes, absolutely. The problem with it, with their definition, the main problem is it reads out a primary embodiment, right? The inventive device is the whole thing. It's both the mold as well as the cradle that it's sitting in. And it specifically says that there's a quote unquote reversible attachment in the specification. Well, that is, the cover is going towards the ear. So you have a primary embodiment under their definition that is completely read out of the specification, that is completely read out. It's nonsensical.
And that's, I also want to ask you about secondary considerations. It's a cross appeal, and I'm giving you a little advance opportunity. The board found there was strong industry praise in copying. And doesn't that count for a lot in terms of non-obviousness?
Not in this instance, Your Honor. I'm glad you prompted me. Let's talk about secondary considerations for just a moment. You can't have a discussion of the secondary considerations without talking about the nexus issue. The reason for that, and I hope the board caught this, I hope the court caught this, is their evidence of nexus, of coextensiveness, right, was really just three paragraphs and an expert declaration saying, here's pictures of the device, and I'm familiar with the device, the Earwell device, right? The Earwell device, which is the commercial product that allegedly embodies the patent, again, has two components. It has what's called in the prior art the conformer, right? And then what's called the cradle or whatnot. In the copying evidence, there's that picture, that blue mold, right, that they have the labeling that they're hoping will save the issue, right, that they introduced in the form of copying. The device is not sold. The device is not used, just the molding, right? The device is not just the mold. There's no coextensiveness shown. So for starters, on the 277 patent, we're done, right? Because the 277 patent actually claims the molding component of that. And there's no labeling or anything like that of how there's coextensiveness of the component, right? No coextensiveness of the cradle, there's no evidence of record also that the cradle was copied, right? Going to the point of the copying. To the point of the copying, I don't think the evidence is strong that there's copying. I understand that what the board found. The reason it's not strong is because of the Bartlett article. So there's citations and discussions of the Bartlett article. Bartlett is the is essentially the principal of Talix. And he was looking at, and there's a paper which he co-authored, where he's looking at multiple prior art references. And as the board correctly found, he said in the industry praise portion of the decision, was that, well, he's very critical. He's very critical in saying that there's a lot of issues with it. For instance, one of the main issues with it is that it's not properly attaching. So like the outer surfaces, right, are supposed to be attaching to the rim. And that's one of the issues it's having. It also doesn't work with a variety of different ear sizes, pediatric ear sizes. So the issue though is that it's not, in order to have copying, there has to be some effort to replicate, right? That's the case law, is that there has to be some effort to replicate, otherwise every instance of infringement would be copied, right? He's not trying to replicate. He's trying to improve. Certainly he had access in trying to design his superior device. He had access to all sorts of prior art references, including their device, but they there was not an effort to replicate. There was an effort to improve. I think that distinguishes.
Can you get to the nexus argument?
Mm-hmm. The nexus argument?
Yeah, with respect to the objective indicia.
Sure. So the nexus, there's no nexus absolutely on the 277 patent. Because the 277 patent...
Because you said before those three paragraphs that was devoted to the nexus argument.
Right. The three paragraphs of the expert report. They're evidence of nexus.
So there is evidence in the record as to nexus.
Which the board found to be insufficient, which is a factual finding, and I think the board was substantially, there's substantial evidence to support the board finding that was insufficient.
Why? Because it's only three paragraphs?
Correct. They're very, and I reprint.
How many paragraphs do you need to establish nexus?
I don't think there's a number, but I think in most instances, more than three sentences and three pictures would not be appropriate. I don't have a bright line number for you, Your Honor, but I don't think that this was enough, particularly where there's no discussion of how the claims are being met. Again, I'm not to suggest that this court should now lay down some rule requiring a claim chart. I don't think that's required, and the prior case law doesn't suggest it does. But there needs to be something a little bit more than just here's pictures of the devices and an expert saying I'm familiar with them, right? I don't think that's enough. I think the board was had substantial justification and substantial evidence to make that conclusion. Again, with the 277 patent, they did go a little further in the copying of the labeling. That doesn't help in the 277 patent because that only dealt with the molding device, the conformer. And then conversely, Fox Factory talks about you having to have components of what you have to identify at the commercial devices as well. The success, any alleged success or industry praise or whatever of the commercial device is on the whole thing, right? It would be on both the cradle and the ear molding as well.
It must be on what's patented, not necessarily what's sold.
Right? Correct. Well, so Fox Factory talks about the spectrum, if you will, of what is the commercial embodiment, right? And where it's just a component of the commercial embodiment, I guess that's more eloquently what I'm trying to get at, where it's just a component of the commercial embodiment, you don't get that presumption that I think Talix took for granted before the board, right? Excuse me, that Began took for granted before the board. So that's because the 924 patent only deals with a component, they don't get that presumption. That's the bottom line of the argument I'm making on the nexus. In addition to that, I think the board had substantial evidence for that. I'm well into my rebuttal time. I suggest yielding and returning, unless there's anything else you'd like to ask at this time.
We will save it for you.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Mr. Kupar.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Do I pronounce your name correctly?
Perfectly. My Croatian parents, thank you for that.
And you don't need your mask unless you want to wear it.
One moment. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'll first address the three appeal issues that Talix brought forth, and I'll reserve as much as my time as to the cross-appeal issues.
Counsel, maybe you can help us by telling us exactly what happens to the case if we reverse on the construction reversibly engaged. How does that affect the remaining arguments?
So if the reversibly engaged only affects claims 5 through 7 of the 942 patent and nothing else.
Okay.
On the two factual issues, claim 4 of the 942 patent, claim 16 of the 942 patent, the short answer there is all of the facts that are raised in the appeal briefing from Talix was considered by the board. There's no clear error. There's no error by the board's decision as to the fact that Dancy does not have a foot, including a broad flat surface, as to claim 4 of the 942 patent. One point I just want to raise for the purpose of this appeal on that issue specifically is that the Talix expert in the declaration with the original petition stated the following, quote, Dancy illustrates a broad flat surface at the bottom of the foot member. And that's at appendix 1876, paragraph 77 of his declaration. Illustrates, he said that. And then the board, of course, stated, looking at all the evidence, that the Dancy reference, the figures there, do not teach or disclose that. And in fact, my colleague here, as he stood up, and he also said this in his blue brief, Talix's blue brief, at page 28, quote, admittedly, the photographs of Dancy do not show the entirety of the surface contacting the patient's skin.
Now, so I want to ask you about secondary considerations. This is your cross appeal. The board said nexus wasn't shown.
Right.
And what you have to have shown is that the patented product is what had the strong industry praise and the copying. And the board said the evidence just was based on a presumption that contained no analysis to support the contention It said only a single sentence appears pertinent to whether the EOL device is covered by the claims. And these are fact findings, aren't they?
Well, Your Honor, they are, and the law is the Polaris case we cited in our briefing. And what the Polaris case did was remand on that basis. There was enough evidence to show a presumption of nexus. And here's what we presented, here's what the board didn't do, and Talix itself did not provide any rebuttal evidence, which was important in the Polaris case. As Judge Reyna identified, the board with those three paragraphs, how much is enough to present for a presumption of nexus? Both of our experts, these are world-class surgeons, identified literal sections that state that the Beacon Earwell device, or excuse me, the 942 patent claims read on the Earwell device. There's literal sections in their declarations.
That is this at 3340, for example, of the joint appendix, Mr. Kubler?
That's right. Appendix 3338 through 3344. Okay. That's right. And the board didn't even address that evidence. And so the Polaris standard is a relatively low standard for presumption. If there's a missing claim limitation in the commercial product, that's the right of the petitioner to raise that in rebuttal and say, hey, this commercial embodiment's missing a limitation, for example. That did not happen here. There's no record evidence of rebuttal evidence from Talix rebutting that presumption of nexus. That presumption of nexus should have carried the day, the evidence we presented. The board didn't even analyze that evidence and then concluded there is no evidence. That's legal error. And at a minimum, that should be a remand per Polaris.
Well, one question I just want to make sure I understand. Claims 1, 3, and 9 of the 942 patent, they involve the issue, I'm looking for the exactly this molding issue,
mm-hmm.
Okay? That's claims one of the 942 patent, right?
Correct.
And then it comes up also in the in various claims of the 277 patent. And in one case, they didn't construe the claim in the case of the 942 patent, but they kind of alternatively construed it in the case of the 277 patent when they were talking about whether to allow you to add in the additional claims. They said even if we accept reshaping, we find that it doesn't do that. Or it does do that. The Japanese reference.
Yes,
I can't pronounce it too well. Have I got the scenario correct?
If I understand where you're going, yes. There's
okay.
How
do we address that situation where they on one hand said that reshaping the Japanese reference did it, but in the other they didn't construe it?
Didn't construe it, right. They only addressed it in one but not the other. The bottom line is where they did address it in that 277, that was flat out error. What we presented was evidence on the Yatsunagi reference. This assumes that...
Pronounced it, thank you.
Yeah, of course. Dr. Yatsunagi is a researcher, you know, in Japan and is a pediatric surgeon, just like our experts are as well, okay? So the issue was, what was Yatsunagi doing there? And the point being is Yatsunagi's device and what our experts did and what Talix's expert did not do, Talix's expert did not analyze those patient cases. This is a medical device case at its core, so you have to look at patient cases. What's outcome? What did the device do? Did it do something? Did it not? And that's the error here. What the Talix expert did in the petition and that...
They did use in the 277 the construction you're urging, kind of alternatively reshaping.
Right, but and that's true. And what the problem is this. In 942 patent, and we identify this in our contingent motion to amend and the alternative, the 942 patent claim one recites mold the helix and helical rim. It does state that limitation. Claim one of the 277 patent does not state that, oddly. So that's why we raise that as an alternative appeal issue here, in case we need to add that. If that's the language that carries the day, that should have been then added in the 277. We think it does, because that's one of the three big functional limitations in claim one of the 942 patents, and then there's two functionals in 277. And those functionals...
Counsel, you wanted to save up to 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm breaking in.
Well, that's your choice.
I'll go down to 7 minutes, about 30 more seconds. I'll make this last one.
Your choice.
Thanks, Your Honor. My point is this on that. The three functional limitations are retain, maintain, and mold. That's what claim one says. The claim one of the 277 doesn't say mold the helix and helical ram. It does say molding device. My point is simple. The prior art needs to show all three of those functional limitations. It doesn't do that. So, for example, with the Yahtzee Unagi reference, Judge Schall, it actually misshapes the ear, and that's what that evidence is showing. Calyx's expert ran away from that. Ours did not. They bore the burden of proof. And I'll stop there and reserve the remainder for my rebuttal time, Your Honors.
We will save the rest for you, assuming there will be something to rebut.
That's right. Fair enough, Your Honor.
Mr. Weaver. You have 344.
There's a lot of time left. I'm tempted not to say anything. But that said, there are a couple of things I do want to still make sure that's addressed. We were talking about scaffold molding, which we didn't get into mine. If I was to make any point on this that may not have come out in the briefs, is that this is really a distinguishing between reshaping. What does molding mean? Does it require a reshaping? I don't think that it's correct to say that a reshaping, it's not so much that it's a reshaping. For them to win their argument, it has to be that it's a reshaping of the ear cartilage, right? The ear is composed of more than just cartilage. It also has skin. There's ear deformities that affect the skin. The specification, and this was talked about, and I didn't see a rebuttal to it in the reply brief, in the patent, within the specification of the patent, there's something called constricted ear. Constricted ear, grade one of constricted ear, is referred to as Tanzer 1 in the specification. Constricted ear can be just dealing with the skin. It doesn't require, you can reshape the ear without necessarily dealing with the skin. I think that gets to the heart of what the board was trying to say when there was no limitation in the claims. The claims don't suggest that it's treating a particular type of deformity, that when you're reshaping, oh, it's only reshaping the cartilage. To read it that way would be, it would suggest that, well, the claims then can't infringe if we're talking about the device being in use for a six-month-year-old. Because under their arguments, according to the evidence that they're presenting, well, 6 months, the cartilage is set, yet alone 6 years, right? That's some of their principal criticisms of the Otsunagi reference, right? So reading it that way, you would say, okay, well, then I guess the claim doesn't infringe anytime it's being used on a six-month-old, because under the evidence, the cartilage is set, so it can't be reshaping. That can't be true. That's nonsensical. So that was one point I wanted to make on the scaffold molding. If nothing else, it might not have come out from that. Really, the only other point I wanted to make was there was a question from the panel about reversibly engaged and what happens on remand. I don't see an argument in the record about reversibly engaged. If we went our definition, the prior art reads on it. Dancy reads on it. I didn't see that rebutted in the record. So there's nothing to remand on this, right? It's either a reversal or an affirmance on that. If we win our definition, Dancy reads on it. If we don't, Dancy doesn't.
You want to restate that? Why wouldn't we remand and let the board look at a different claim construction?
Because there's no argument of record. Remanding is not necessary if it's just unrebutted in the record. There's no argument of record as to how Dancy doesn't meet the limitations under our definition. Put another way, if you agree that our definition is a superior definition, there's no argument of record how Dancy doesn't meet that. It all rises and falls in the definition of reversibly engaged. So at least on that point, remand shouldn't be necessary. In my last minute, we did not get to claim 16, which is the arcuate shape. I just wanted to make sure that it was clear for the panel. It's a very straightforward argument that I can do in 45 seconds. Again, they just missed it. There's annotated figure 6. I never saw a citation in the board petition to annotated figure 6. There's a string site. They talk about all the sort of references, all the figures in Yotsunagi. Annotated figure 6 clearly shows that little arc on what would be considered the scaffold mold. They referenced figures 2, 3, and 4 in the decision. That's talked about at length. I understand the criticism, but had they considered annotated figure 6, they would have come to a different decision on that. So no substantial evidence. With 10 seconds left, any other questions I can answer? Thank you for your time.
Guess not. Mr. Kupar, you made a strategic decision to save time to rebut on the cross-appeal, and I don't think I heard anything on the cross-appeal just said. So Unless you tell me I'm wrong, I think you've waived your remaining time.
I've waived my remaining time, Your Honor, at that point. But there is something on the appeal issue that he did raise.
Well, on the appealed issue, appellee doesn't get a second argument.
That's true.
Right. So, well, we've heard your argument. We've been all ears, and we'll take the case under submission.